Morning, everyone. This is the final one of this year. This Jewish year means. We're doing the series of festival symbols, which is part three. Just want to remind everyone that we have another section on Thursday morning this year, Sukkot. So the first 2 days of Sukkot are Tuesday and Wednesday. Then the third day, the weekday of Chol HaMoed of Sukkot, is on Thursday, 9th of October, via My Sukkah, as we always do every year. Please come along. Actually, please come along hungry, because you guys never eat anything. And that's the whole point. It's a mitzvah to eat in the Sukkah, you know. All those unhealthy rugelach and things, you know. That's right. Oh, I agree. So we'll do. I'll send out the exact time. Watch the WhatsApp, but that'll be that. And then the next term, we will begin the new series, which I'll send out details of on the 23rd of October. 23rd. No, but Sukkot will break it up. It's okay. Yeah. So today's the last one. Then Sukkot, 9th of October, in my house. And then back here, 23rd of October. Okay. So just a quick review of last week. Last week we talked about the fish, the mixture of the two things, this idea of a head. Some people actually have the head of a ram, as I talked about, to remember the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, and the lessons we can learn from that. We talked about the idea of eating a head of anything, which is the concept of leadership, internal leadership, being a leader, not a follower. Leaders making decisions that are good for the leadership, not because they want their people they're leading to feel happy, but within our own experience, the head being the leader of our emotional experience and our behavior experience, and to submit to that head. Then we talked about fish, why fish is so important, Rosh Hashanah, protection from the evil eye. And we learned a lesson from kosher fish, which is fins and scales. Scales represent the protection. Protection of our ego, the protection of how we make decisions, and fins represent ambition and quantum leap growth. But the fins without the scales are dangerous. So that's why the Talmud says every fish that has scales automatically has fins, because when you have the right protection and you're protected and you're guided and so on, then your growth is almost guaranteed to be there, but also to be there effectively and in the right way. Okay. I want to talk about one particular thing today, but just before we do that, I'm just going to run through very quickly, just for interest's sake, what some of the other simanim are, some of the other signs. So we have these come from the Talmud, actually, and it's become very popular lately to, the Sfaradim always did this. Ashkenazim of late are doing it more. The Talmud refers to something called Rubia. Rubia is... And in some versions, it's called Lubia. So what's the significance of that? So Rubia means, comes to the word Rav, which is many. And Lubia comes to the word Lev, which is the heart. And the prayer that goes with that one is that we ask God that, number one, our merits. We do a lot of this talk on Rosh Hashanah. Our merits should be abundant. And also that He should show His heart to us. He should hearten us, as they call it. Okay. Then there's one called Karti. Karti is a... Sorry, I missed one. The date. Some people have a date. The date is an important one. The date also is one of these fruits from Israel, one of these fruits that symbolize the Jewish people. But the reason that the Talmud says to use a date on the Rosh Hashanah table is the word tamar, the word in Hebrew for date is tamar, right? And the first two letters of that is tam. Tam means to finish, to go away. An end, in other words, the end, right? In many books, sometimes at the end of the entire tractate of the Talmud, there's a line at the end called Tam Vinishlam. It's finished and completed. One of the reasons we... Yeah?
Isn't Tam simple
as well? It can be simple, yes, but it also comes to the word to finish. Hebrew has that kind of thing where sometimes a word can mean many different things depending on the context. So the reason that we take a date, so people have a date on Rosh Hashanah, is because we ask God that our enemies and haters and those who wish evil upon us should come to an end. Very relevant. There's a few of them that are extra powerful this Rosh Hashanah, perhaps. And that leads into the leek, which in Hebrew or Aramaic actually is karti. Karti means to cut off. And we ask God that our enemies, again, and haters, should be cut down, in other words, they should be defeated, right? And also that's got to do with the another one, the beets, which are called silka. Siluk comes to the word to depart, to go away. And we ask God for all those that hate us and wish us evil to go away, basically. There's another one which is interesting called the kara, which is a gourd. I don't even know what a gourd is.
What is it?
It's like a pumpkin? It's like a pumpkin?
It's a vegetable. Is it a fruit? Is it a vegetable?
Vegetable.
It's like a squash.
It's like a squash, right? Yeah.
What is it?
A gourd, a squash, a pumpkin of some sort, yeah.
Do we get it here?
A butternut. Yeah, you can take one of those, anyways. Now, it's interesting, in Hebrew, or in Aramaic again, the word is kara kuf resh aleph, but it also can be read as kara kuf resh ayin, which means two different things. Kara means to call, like to be announced, like likro, to call, to beckon. And also kara with an ayin means to tear up. And that's why the tefillah, the machzor, that goes with this particular siman, is that any evil that would be potentially part, like we say at the end of an etane tokef, we say, or we use the word likra, in avinim akena, I'm sorry, kra roa gzar dineinu, tear up any evil part of our decree. So we ask God to just tear up anything that might be negative. And on the contrary, what should be announced, which is the aleph, should be announced all our merits and all the good deeds that Hashem should give us blessing because of those. Those are just some of the things. I'll just mention that. I mention them because it's interesting, and I mention the Talmud, and some people do this. I wouldn't drive yourself absolutely crazy to go to every fruit store in town to make sure you can get all of these. The apple is important, the pomegranate is fairly important. Fish, if you can, head of the fish, even better. But whatever you can get of the others is good. Don't.
So are any of them mitzvot, or are they all just...
They're all custom, apples? And the custom... They're strong customs, meaning it's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, the concept of having good symbols on the table. So, but I mean that, you know, that develops other things as well. Like the apple, is honey is one of them. And
is apple and honey a mitzvah or just a custom?
It's a custom mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, which means it's a custom which has the force of a law, in a way. Okay. But not as important as the next thing we're going to talk about. So that's why I'll get to that. Okay. Yeah. All the things are very important. However, the biggest symbol of all on Rosh Hashanah is the shofar. Yeah. That's hands down, right? That's a mitzvah, it's a mitzvah of the Torah. And it's a very, very, very powerful, not just a symbol, a powerful mitzvah. And what I want to spend today sharing with you some lessons we can learn from the shofar, what it means. Some of them we have mentioned in previous years, but it's always good to review them before Rosh Hashanah to be prepared and focused. Really important to be in shul on Rosh Hashanah and hear the shofar. If you can't, let me know, because there's people blowing shofar during the day in all parts of the city. And we can always make sure that you hear the shofar, even if you don't do it in shul, but it should be heard every day, at least the one set, in other words, the 30 sounds, we call them. Both days. I mean, the Torah talks about one day, because originally, biblically, Rosh Hashanah is one day, but it's actually nowadays, for many, since the Talmudic times, since the Temple times already, it's two days, a rabbinic day as well, so they're both important, they're both obligatory, and hearing the shofar is really, really important. So why do we have the shofar? So we're interesting. There's so many reasons and lessons and insights. But actually, I want to begin with something very interesting that the Rambam, Maimonides, just says very briefly when he talks about the reason, he talks about the lesson from the shofar. He just slips in a phrase that it's very easy to miss, but it's an important phrase. And he says the following. He says, talks about the shofar, and he says that even though, he says, this is the slip-in phrase, even though Gzeirat HaKatuvu, it's just a commandment. You do it because God said so. However, he says, Remez Yeshbo. There's a lot of hints, a lot of insights that are alluded to by the shofar. In other words, the Rambam makes this point, we talk about such an important shofar. In fact, the Talmud says that Mitzvat HaYom B'Shofar, the essence of Rosh Hashanah is the shofar. I mean, there's a custom even to blow it every day during the month of Elul, but that's just a custom. But the mitzvah is on Rosh Hashanah, and the Talmud says, of course, we daven on Rosh Hashanah, we eat apple and honey, we have great meals, we have family, all this stuff, all good. But if you want to know what the essence of Rosh Hashanah is, the shofar, right? And the Rambam says, it's got so many reasons, and we know the Reb Sadia Gaon, for example, in the 9th, 10th century, He famously, it's printed in the art scroll Machzor, I think. He gives 10 reasons why we blow the shofar, right? All different things it reminds us of and so on. All good, but the Rambam says the real reason is because God said so. Why is that so important? It's so important because we know that the theme of Rosh Hashanah, and in fact it's linked to the shofar, is committing to God as king. Avinu Malkeinu is our father. We mentioned that with great emphasis. He's our father, he's full of love and so on, but he's also Malkeinu, he's our king. And he wants us to live a certain way. He wants us to live with meaning and purpose. And he wants us to follow a certain code, a certain formula of a moral code and a value code and a behavior code, which he sets out for us in the Torah. And not always is it easy to grow and to involve and to engage with that code, because some of the things are hard to understand. Some of the things don't make sense. Sometimes, to us at least. And one of the things that we do in Rosh Hashanah is this concept of surrender. We talk about the whole prayer of Rosh Hashanah is, Melach, be our king, please be our king, we'll give ourselves over to you, we are your subjects, Avinu Malkeinu, and so on, right? And part of that experience is the concept of surrender. Not negative surrender, we've talked about this before, positive surrender. Where we understand our limitations, we understand our finiteness, and we surrender to something which is clearly infinitely greater than ourselves. And that's part of not being selfish. That's part of not being self-absorbed. Part of getting rid of the ego as the foundation to the year is surrendering. And that's why the Rambam says, actually, the first reason you blow the shofar, the first lesson, is really that it has no reason. You just do it because God said so. And that in itself is a powerful thing. That in itself is an incredibly powerful experience. Okay. Because it's so integral to our whole relationship with Hashem that we don't, well, of course, we want to understand, and it's critical to understand and learn and become enthusiastic and excited about things and understand the deeper meaning and so on. But the foundation of who we are is we don't wait to understand. We don't wait to make sense or to resonate with us. We do it because we're connecting to something greater than ourselves. However, the Rambam continues in that sentence. Remez Yeshboy says, but there's a hint. There's lots of hints to the shofar. Lots of reasons, lots of things that are connected. So there is stuff we can understand and stuff we can learn from. What I want to do, I'm going to share with you five ideas. I think I put them there in a list, right? I think so, yeah. Yeah. Basically, it's the wake-up call, the pure spark, internalizing, growing from pain, and changing the animal. Now, let's explain. So the first one, in fact, this is the one that the Rambam actually talks about, is that it's a wake-up call. He quotes a beautiful pasuk. He says, Uru yishenim mishinatchem, wake up, those who sleep from your sleep. Wake up, the sleepers from their sleep. And those who slumber, wake up from your slumber. What's the difference between sleeping and slumbering, other than just being different English words? But I've just learned recently a discourse from the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, and explains the following. He says, when a person sleeps, some of the stuff still works. Like, you know, you can hear when you sleep, that's why you get woken up, Okay, the one that's most, but you know, the faculties and the parts of the functionality of the body become weakened. Most notably, the sight, the power of sight, because you close your eyes. But they haven't stopped. So like, it's weakened, and I guess they're confused. And that's a symbol of those in life that, you know, we try our best, but kind of we lose lack of clarity. We lose clarity. We become confused. We're fashlofen, as they say in Yiddish. Put it that way. I think that's the best way to describe it. But he says, tardema, which is a deep slumber, that's when things don't make sense at all. We're not functioning. We're completely asleep. So different levels of sleeping. And the Rambam says that the reason we blow shofar is an alarm clock, a spiritual alarm clock. It's the idea of waking up. But I want to just develop that a bit because I think it's really important to understand what this means. What does it mean, wake up? And what do we do when we wake up, right? So I think this is a really important lesson in the times that we live in, because in the modern times, I mean. We all know that in the modern times, all the technology and all the amazing conveniences that we have, what it's actually resulted in, it's all very good and it's fantastic, but actually people's lives are just simply less calm. We're just rushing, we're trying to accomplish so much, we're trying to go from one thing to another, trying to be ambitious. Ambition is not a bad thing, depending on how it's done. And we're just all over the place. I think we live in a time that we are more over the place than ever. I don't know, just like, I remember my grandparents, they were a lot calmer than we are. Yeah. Just by nature, the time they lived in, things took longer. people had more patience. I mean, I'm not such an old guy, I don't think. Maybe not, but maybe I am. But I was in yeshiva, we wrote letters, like, you know, what do you call those? L letters, what do they used to call them?
Aerograms.
Aerograms, yeah. Right? The blue ones, I don't know. Yeah. Right? And once in a while, I used to call collect from the yeshiva dormitory. They had a pay phone there, public phone. So you couldn't just put in quarters to call overseas. It wouldn't be, used to call collect. You know, remember collect, reverse charges. Do you want to accept the call? Those kind of things, right? But it took longer. People were just more patient. You waited for a call. You didn't worry so much. I mean, when my kids went to yeshiva, if I didn't hear from them in 15 minutes, I started to panic. You know, it's like ridiculous. But we're just running, and we're running, and we're checking our phone. We're doing all sorts of things. And what it's resulted in lots of not good things, but what it's also resulted in is that we're constantly on the treadmill. We're always on the treadmill of life. We don't stop. We don't stop to think, to review, to reevaluate, to check in with our values. We're always, as you heard me say before, we're always doing. We never stop to just be. And sometimes doing is so important, that's what we're here for. We're here to accomplish. But what are we accomplishing? What's guiding our accomplishment? What's guiding our doing? So once in a while, we have to stop and just be and reflect and recheck ourselves and where are we up to? What have I accomplished? That's the whole idea of Elul, the idea of Cheshbon. And that's why we actually start blowing the shofar even in Elul, just to wake ourselves up and say, just stop. Wake up and stop. Stop and notice. Stop and think. Stop and evaluate. There's a story of the first Chabad Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe. He was the founder of the Chabad Hasidus movement, and after a while, he had a lot of detractors and people didn't like him, and they got him arrested by the Russian government. The official reason he was arrested was because he used to send money to Israel. Israel was then under the Turkish Ottoman Empire, and a lot of poor people in Israel then, and he had a whole fund, which still exists till today, called Kollel Chabad, which was to send money to Israel. And of course, Russia and Turkey were then enemies, and they spread a libel to him to the government that he's supporting the enemy, because he's sending money to Israel, which was then enemy lines, right? Anyway, that's just the background. But when he was in jail for 52 days, and when he was in jail, and then he came out, and it was a big celebration. When he was in jail, he was visited by a government official who came incognito, because he heard about this person sitting in jail. He heard he's a big rabbi, he's a big tzaddik, and all, and he wanted to check him out, seriously. This guy was a fairly knowledgeable person, and he came in to speak to the Alter Rebbe, and he said he wants to ask him a Bible question. Alter Rebbe says, fine. So he told him in the very beginning of Bereshit, there's a story which actually happened on Rosh Hashanah, because we know that Rosh Hashanah is the anniversary of the creation of Adam and Eve, the sixth day of creation, that's when they were created. It's also the day that they messed up and ate from the fruit they weren't supposed to eat from. Then they hid because they realized what they'd done and they were embarrassed. Then they heard the voice of God calling out to them saying, Ayeka, where are you? So he asked the Alter Rebbe, God is all-knowing, right? So obviously he knew where Adam and Eve were. They were hiding behind the tree or whatever they were doing. So why do you ask Ayeka? What do you ask? Where are you? So firstly, the Alter Rebbe replied to him, there's a famous Rashi, the famous commentator on Chumash, says that God, of course, knew where they were, but he wanted to just enter into a soft conversation. He didn't want to startle them or frighten them. So he says, where are you? And then he admonished them. So the officer turned to the Alter Rebbe and says, I actually know that. That's a Rashi, of course. I know the Rashi. But I want something different. I want something deeper. So the Alter Rebbe became very serious. And he talked to him and he said, I want to tell you what it means. When God calls out and he says, Ayeka, it wasn't to find out where they were geographically. It was an eternal question to every single human being. And then he went on and he said the following. God turns to a person who's a certain age, and he mentions this officer's age, who has a wife and he has so many children. He mentions the number of children that he had with his divine insight. And he said, God looks at that person and says, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you up to? Where are you holding, as we say in more yeshivish English, right? Where are you holding? Where are you holding in life? What are you doing? What meaning and purpose do you think, right? So that's really, and of course he was amazingly impressed, and I think it contributed a bit to his release afterwards. But this happened on Rosh Hashanah. So every Rosh Hashanah, maybe, we blow the shofar, and the shofar is a question. It's where are you? Ayeka, wake up call. Think about, Reflect on your values. Reflect on where you're up to in your spiritual growth. Reflect on where you're up to in your family. Where you're up to in every part of meaningful parts of life. And we try in Rosh Hashanah to commit and to answer that question a little bit and take the next step into the next year. Okay. That's number one. Number two, at the same time, however, we need to know what the shofar also represents. Because it's important when we answer the question of where are you that we don't become upset. And we don't define ourselves negatively. And we don't carry guilt that we shouldn't carry. Because what the shofar also represents, as the Baal Shem Tov explained, it represents the cry from the very depths of the soul. What does that mean? It comes, Rosh Hashanah, the shofar is above words. It can't be expressed in words. So we know that the shofar represents a cry from us. On the one hand, it's a call from God, a wake-up call. But it's also a cry from us. From where? Which part of us? The very depth of our soul. Because what we need to understand is that we have a part of our neshama. We've talked about it so many times, but it's really important to reflect again upon it before Rosh Hashanah. We all have what we call a pintel yid. We all have a part of our soul that is always pure. The part of our soul that never messed up. The part of our soul that never was broken. The part of our soul that was just is always pure. It's always pristine. And when everything else fails, That's what we reveal on Rosh Hashanah. We come to God and say, we want to connect you at a very deep level because ultimately that's who we really are. Yes, on a conscious level, we've had ups, we've had downs, we've been successful, we haven't been successful, we've done good things, we haven't done such good things. But we come to you from the depths of who we are, we come to you from where we really are and who we really are, which is that cry from the essence of the neshama. So I had a very interesting moment. I said this just this past Wednesday night. We had a beautiful Kayemet event with, you know, a whole group of young adults. It was very nice with music and everything. And I told the story. It's a moment that I had last Shabbat. I was in shul up the road. And they were starting Kabbalat Shabbat. And a very young child came in. He must be, I don't know, probably not even two. Couldn't speak, that's for sure. And he looked lost, he looked scared. And he was going from one table to another, and I figured it must be someone's kid. I just turned to someone, I didn't know who he was. I said, does anyone know who this child belongs to? And as I was talking about that, this child started to cry. And as he started to cry, he didn't see his father, that's why he was behind a wall or something. His father appeared, picked him up, hugged him, and he started to smile, and he was okay, calm down. And I was just watching this, and I thought to myself, wow, that's Rosh Hashanah. Why? See, Rosh Hashanah, by the way, Rosh Hashanah is such an important day because it's called Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year. It doesn't say beginning of the year. In English, you say new year, but it's not. It's the head of the year. Just like the head within a body affects the entire body, sets the tone for the body, the brain controls everything that happens in the human experience. So to Rosh Hashanah sets the tone for the year. And on Rosh Hashanah, we are that child. What does that mean? We lost. We also feel lost, especially this year. Some of us feel lost. Some of us know we've done things maybe we shouldn't have done. Some of us are confused. Some of us are scared. Scared for Israel, scared for Australia. Lonely, worried, right? People have personal challenges, complications, spiritual challenges, inner turmoil. We have collective challenges. But a lot of amazing things have happened. But at the same time, there's still so many challenges. Hashas are still in captivity as we approach Rosh Hashanah. Chayilim are still getting hurt. There's so much. There's orphans, there's Buddhas, so much, right? So we don't even know anymore what we're feeling. And sometimes we come to Rosh Hashanah and we don't even know how to express it properly. We know we lost, but we don't know why. And we don't know how to express it. And so like the child who can't speak and can't explain, and maybe we don't even know how to daven properly, but we do know that we have a father. And we're looking for him because we can't see him. So what do? We cry. We take the shofar and we blow it. And that's the cry of the child. That little child, that's the cry of the child. What does that cry represent? The cry represents is that when there's nothing else and there's just confusion and darkness, but that spark, that unbreakable bond between father and child is still there. And that's what's coming out in the child who doesn't... He's lost, he's confused, he's scared, but he's still yearning for his father. That's the cry of the shofar. That's what the Baal Shem Tov said. The Baal Shem Tov said the cry of the shofar is like a son of a king who's come back and he's just gone off the way. He's lost himself. He doesn't know what he's doing. He can't even speak the language, but he can cry. And then what happens is we cry, we say, Avinu Malkeinu, we say, where are you? And as we cry, and this is what we have to believe in, and this is what we have to go into Rosh Hashanah, we're going to do the crying. We're going to try our best. But as soon as we cry, like in a little story I saw last week, the Father appears. And he picks us up. And he says, I've never abandoned you. I will never abandon you. Yes, for a few seconds you can't see me. That's true. But let me hold you and let me take you further. And it's a new year. It's a new energy. It's a new power. And let's start fresh. And that's the shofar. But it needs preparation. It needs to be able to reflect on that part of the soul. Because like we said before, in terms of our reflection and stopping to think, we often just behave on the consciousness. We behave on the conscious part of our soul. We forget about the deep spark that is deeply buried within our existence. If you see this in my message tomorrow, don't worry. Just it'll be repetition because I'll send it out. But for me, it was a very, very powerful moment. I think it's such an important perspective. So before Rosh Hashanah, we have to reflect a little bit. And we have to tap into what we're feeling. And maybe part of that feeling is a spiritual loss. Maybe we know that we should do better and we're not, and we're a bit far and we just can't see the fall. Whatever the reason is. So that we can feel the shofar. Obviously, we just got to do the shofar anyway because it's whatever we feel we don't because it's a mitzvah. But we have to try and tap in. That's why in shul, when they blow the shofar, there's a whole preparation. There's whole verses of Tehillim they say first and the whole thing, right? Because it's, want to get into the moment, want to experience the moment. And we should cry. We should feel that. We should say to Hashem, where are you? We don't see you. And He will respond. He will appear. And He will say, I see you. I embrace you. I take you with me. And let's start the new year again. But we have to have that emunah. We have to have that faith that that's what's going to happen. We're going to do the crying, but He's going to do the answering. And we'll be a better year. We have to believe that with absolute conviction. That it's going to be a better year. It's going to be, as the popular song goes now, Od Yer Teh Tov, right? Okay. Third idea I want to say is that just, and this we've talked about before, but I just want to mention it again. And that's the, what is the mitzvah of shofar? So we have an interesting thing. If you want to know what a mitzvah is, what the definition of the mitzvah is, we talk about tkiyat shofar, blowing the shofar, right? But actually, that's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to listen to the shofar. If you want to know why I say that, because have a look at the blessing that is made before we blow the shofar. We bless God like we do before every mitzvah or most mitzvot. And we say, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotam v'tzivanu. We thank Him for sanctifying us and making us holy with His mitzvot. V'tzivanu, by commanding us to do what? Doesn't say litkoa shofar, to blow the shofar. It says lishmoa kol shofar, to hear it. Right? Why is that so important? That's not always true, by the way. Sometimes, for example, it's interesting. I'll just explain you how this works halachically. So on Purim, for example, there's a mitzvah to listen to the Megillah. But actually, that's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to read the Megillah, which you can do by listening, because there's a halachic mechanism that when you listen to someone like Kiddush on Friday night, it's not mitzvah to listen to Kiddush, it's a mitzvah to make Kiddush. But the halacha tells us, the Jewish law mechanism is, we have a principle that when you listen to someone, it's like you're saying the words. Right? Okay, fine. But the shofar is specifically not like that. Shofar, the mitzvah is not to blow the shofar and we can just be covered by someone else. No, the mitzvah is to listen to the shofar. What's the difference? What's the lesson? Listening means to internalize. Listening means when you really absorb something and you becomes part of you. When someone blows something, you can hear it but not listen. Not really listen. You can know there's a call, there's an inspiration. Think about times that you've been very, very inspired about something and you got all excited but it didn't change you. Like for me, that's like every week, right? I mean, I can learn something inspiring, but it doesn't change me. Why? Because I'm not listening to it. I'm learning it, I'm understanding it, I'm picking up the signals, but I'm not internalizing it. Because that's the challenge. The challenge, you've got to internalize it. And in fact, that's the whole story of Elul and Rosh Hashanah. Where in history does the whole thing start? Just let's remind ourselves. The whole thing starts with, after the Torah was given, which is way back in Shavuot, Moses goes up on the mountain. This is after the Jews have come out from Egypt. 7 weeks later, they get the Torah, Mount Sinai. This amazing revelation, right? We've talked about this before as well. And God gives us the Ten Commandments, and then 40 days later, boom, they serve the golden calf. Right? What happened? What happened was because the whole story of Pesach and Shavuot was an important story because that's how you start. But we weren't absorbing because it was all being done for us. We didn't know what we were doing, so God just swept us out, inspired us, come, let's go. Out of Egypt, let's give you the Torah, you're my nation, boom. But it didn't become who we are. It was an inspiration from outside. It was something we were being swept up by, but it wasn't becoming us. So God broke the luchot and then hid himself and then gave us Elul. We know that the whole process is Moses went up in the third time in the mountain, on the mountain, from the first day of Elul till Yom Kippur. That's why Yom Kippur is Yom Kippur. There's a 40-day period from the beginning of Elul to Yom Kippur, where it comes down the mountain with the second tablets and God forgives us for the golden calf. That's why ever since, these 40 days have been the days of reflection, the days of reconnection, the days of tshuva, the days of return, but in a different way. God says, now this time I'm not going to make a big bang revelation of Mount Sinai. This time you're going to work it out yourself. You are going to absorb it. You're going to become, it's going to become you. And that's why Rosh Hashanah, the mitzvah is not someone blows and we just love the music. No. Lishma, we listen, we internalize it, and it becomes who we are. And that's the other message from the third message from the blowing of the shofar. Okay. Number four is growing from challenge. Let's understand how this works. This idea, by the way, it's many places, but it was clearly sort of explained by the second Hasidic rabbi of the Hasidic sect of Gur, they call it. It was a Polish town called Gur. And he was a great rabbi, the Sfat Emet, he was called. And he explained the structure of the shofar. So let me just explain halachically, just to review. We have done this before, but just let's get it again. So it's interesting how we blow the shofar, right? I should have actually bought my shofar to demonstrate. Okay, but we'll explain it. So we blow the shofar with a certain system. And it goes back to the essential mitzvah. The essential mitzvah is actually not as long as we do it. We do it much longer than the mitzvah. But why? The mitzvah of the Torah is to blow 9 sounds. How so? The Torah tells us to go a tkiyah, truah, tkiyah, 3 times. Now, what's a tkiyah? We all know what a tkiyah. Tkiyah is the long sound. Like, ooh, right? That's the tkiyah. Then there's a truah. Truah is like a broken sound. Right? A broken sound. Which is then followed by another tkiyah. So, long sound, broken sound, long sound, right? And that broken sound in the Torah is called the truah. The problem is we don't actually know what that broken sound is. And it's one of 3 options. It's that's a whole discussion in the Talmud. Why? Because to use the names that we use, in other words, what is that middle brokenness, right? Is it what we call today shvarim, which is sort of broken sounds but a bit longer, like tu, 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 or is what we call truah, tu, 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 right? Or is it what we call shvarim truah, which you start off with the longer ones, tu, 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 and then you go tu, 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 right, all together. What's the idea? It's all because the shofar is crying. That's what it is. It's crying. So it says the Talmud, there's 3 ways of crying. Some people just kvetch. That's like the longer ones. Oi, oi, oi. That's the shvarim, right? Some people are hysterical. They can't go, oi. They go, they're hysterical. They go, oi, 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 oi. That's the truah, right? Tu, 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 tu. Yeah, that's what it says.
Yeah.
And some people, what they do is, they start off by kvetching and then they descend into hysteria. Yeah. Right? That's basically the idea. So what do we do in order to make sure the first time Rosh Hashanah at the Bimah, just after reading the Torah in Shul, or if you do it during the day, we end up blowing 30 sounds because we want to do the mitzvah, so we want to cover it. So we do each option 3 times. So we do tkiyah, shvarim, truah, tkiyah, 3 times. Tkiyah, shvarim, tkiyah, 3 times. And tkiyah, truah, tkiyah, 3 times. Okay? Is it? Yeah? That's a crash course in the complexities of the halachot of blowing the shofar. Okay. But at the end of the day, it always remains the same structure. You've got a long, smooth sound, a broken sound of sorts, whichever it is, and then a long, smooth sound. Says the Sfat Emet, this is the story of life. And the story of how we're supposed to approach life. When a baby is born, or when we start off sometimes fresh, a new day, whatever the case is, it starts off as a tkiyah. Things are smooth. Things are wonderful, happy, calm, tkiyah, nice, long, beautiful sound. And then starts the trua. The challenges of life. Bigger challenges, smaller challenges, shvarims, truas, whatever. But challenges, everyone has shvarims, truas, some stage of life. We always daven and we pray that you kept at a very, very, very big minimum. But they happen. Sometimes they're bigger, sometimes they're smaller. Sometimes they're monumental, sometimes they're individual, sometimes they're collective, whatever the case is. And then, of course, there's two ways to mention, to approach those truah. Two ways. One is despair and giving up hope and giving up and becoming down and despondent. Or we take it on. We take it on and we grow from challenge. And we use it as an opportunity. Some people have this naturally. Some people do it better. You know, I just saw, there's so many stories about this, right? Throughout our history. But just something very recent. There's a podcast. It's called Inspiration for the Nation. It's a guy in America. His name is Yaakov Langer. He does it every week, actually. I listen once in a while, so I should say. And he interviews these people who have a story, have an amazing story. That's what it is. Just recently, such a beautiful podcast. He interviewed a couple, both in their second marriage, but they got married a bit later. They live in California. So the man, he grew up in Israel. He was from the Hasidic group of Belz, a Belz Hasid. Got married fairly young. Didn't work out. They had one son. He went to America. They got divorced and he went to America. He was a bit, yeah. She was a Sephardi, is a Sephardi, I should say. Quite a combination, actually. A Hasidic guy from Eretz Yisrael with a Sephardi woman. Grew up completely secular, found a way to Yiddishkeit, married an amazing guy, also very, you know. Then they didn't have children for quite a long time. They had children. They had two children. And then he got very, very, very sick with heart disease. Went through a terrible time of being in hospitals a few years. Had to have a heart transplant eventually. Was successful. Eventually came back home. And then they went on a camping trip. And he got bitten by a mosquito. And he got, I've got what it's called. They got that virus. What's it called, the virus? Yeah, something in it. And actually eventually died. So here you have a guy. He's now in California. He's trying to build himself up again. He's down in the dumps. And he has this idea. He obviously wants to get married again. He has this idea that, because when he was in California, he said he was sometimes very lonely, especially on Shabbos. People invited him, not always, you know, that kind of thing. So he built this idea in his head that he's going to help people eventually when he settles down and when he can. He went into business. He actually was quite successful. And then he met this woman a year later. It was an interesting thing. I think this is interesting. It's a little cute part of the story. It's not relevant to one of the lessons, but I'll just tell you a cute part of the story. So he comes from a Hasidic background. So on Shabbos, he wears what's called a shtreimel. You know what a shtreimel is? Like a fur thing, right? And she comes from a Sephardi background, which is the furthest thing from a shtreimel you can even imagine, right? And her daughters were reading some book, some Jewish book about the, I don't know, about something. And in the book, there was a picture of a guy with a shtreimel. And his little kid turns to her mother and says, "Mommy, I want a tati like that with a shtreimel." And it happens, right? Anyway, they're both coming from very, her story is like unimaginable, the pain and everything. They go on a date. Someone put them up and they go on a date. And this guy, you know, like a real Israeli, I suppose, the first date, he says, "I just want to tell you one thing." He says, "If when I get married, I want a Shabbat table that is full. Like 20 people at least, you know? 20 people, 25 people, 40, whatever." He wants to just lay it down right away, just in case, you know? He doesn't want to marry someone who's not interested in the guest. And she said, "You know what? I'm dreaming of that. Because we used to have that when I was married. That's all we used to have, a lot of guests." So that's how the dating, not a typical dating scene of how it starts, but that's what it starts. They got married. And they've now done an amazing thing. They've taken their background and her medical understanding, because she'd been through so many years of having to care for her late husband. And they started this amazing organization called L.A. Lev. What is it? Thank God he made it well. He built himself a house. And behind the house, they built five like apartments. And it's for people who come to California, the certain treatments that are, you know, every city has their specialty medical expertise. I'm not sure what California's is, but People come. People often come. And what they do is they take them on, not just give them a place to stay if they can't afford all the treatment and everything like that. They help them, they adopt them, they become their family. And it's just this amazing kindness, this amazing chesed, right? And they have every Shabbos, not only from the people that stay, every Shabbos, it's 40 people now. And they love Shabbat, and they love helping people. And they built this whole organization on helping people who come to a city so they shouldn't feel alone. And they shouldn't feel lost, and they shouldn't feel like they don't know where to go and who to talk to and what advice to get. Not everyone has networks. Not everyone can access that kind of information. And it's an amazing thing, and people are being helped every single day. What did they do? They had a big trua in their life, a big brokenness, big complication, and they didn't fall apart. They took it and said, we're going to change this. We're going to use this information. We're going to use this experience to create even a bigger tkia. And that's what the Sfas Emes says. That when you approach the broken sounds in the middle, what you produce is a bigger tkia, a new level smooth sound. You started off with a smooth sound that was smooth to begin with. But now you come with the richness of experience and complications and knowledge and failure and everything that goes with challenge. And what you've done, you turn it in. That's the message of Rosh Hashanah. We look at the past, but we don't get stuck in the past. We don't despair from the past. But we use the past to create an amazing future, an amazing tomorrow. So we do that in order to have the second tkiah. And in fact, some people have a custom that when they blow these sets of the tkiah, the broken sound, the tkiah, they make sure that the second tkiah is always longer than the first. Because that's what it symbolizes. That tkiah, that smooth sound that comes out, it's actually a much bigger tkiah, much greater, much deeper tkiah than the first one. So that's the fourth insight from the shofar. And the fifth one is the following. And this is the lesson we need to take and what we're going to do with all of this. So it's all very good, it's all very nice. It's a wake-up call, it's a shofar, it's a sound, it's a cry, etc. But why the actual shofar? And this is what the commentaries asked. It's all true, but if it's all got to do with this emotional outpour and expression of the soul and the commitment and the crowning of the king and the wake-up call, what do we need something from a ram, from an animal? What is that doing on the bima, on the shofar, right? You want to cry, if it's the mitzvah to cry, so let's make a crying sound. I don't know, we can do that without a horn, right? Why the horn? Why the animal horn? Any ideas? What? Yeah, I mean, there is a symbolism of reminding ourselves of the Akedah, true, of the ram's horn, and then also at the giving of the Torah, which when God blew the shofar. The shofar will also herald in the coming of Mashiach. But what's the idea as part of this mitzvah to actually have a horn from an animal sitting on the bima, and that's what we use? And the answer is very simple. Because the shofar, first of all, in Judaism, everything's tangible. It's a religion of action, right? But it's deeper than that. We all know, we've talked about this millions of times, that we have two parts of our existence, two parts of our experience. We have the nefesh al-akit, the godly soul, the godly part of who we are, and then we have the animal component of who we are, right? And what happens when it comes to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, amazing days, beautiful days, powerful days, strong days, inspiring days, we actually become inspired, hopefully. And we should. We should try. We should work to become inspired. We should sit in shul and hear the shofar and move a little bit. We should understand and remember the expression of the soul, the crying of the child. That's all good, all true. But when that happens, you know who's crying? Not your animal. Your soul is crying. That's what it comes from. It comes from the soul. The awakening comes from the soul. The commitment comes from the soul. But it can't remain with the soul. And the reason why we pick up a shofar and all of that we express through an animal horn is because what we need to try and do in the coming year, we have to take that awakening of this special time of the year, the faith building, the strength, the resilience, the spirituality, and we have to try and translate it and extend it to the animal part of who we are, to our body, to our behavior, to our physical functionality every single day. And that's why I've said this before, but it's such an important thing. It doesn't have to be huge. We have to take reasonable steps, but we have to come into Rosh Hashanah with some plan, especially Yom Kippur. We have to just think about, what can I do? What tangible mitzvah can I do in the coming year that's a bit different? How can I translate the cry of the shofar into the animal horn, into the animal part of Oye? In fact, this concept is not only Rosh Hashanah. In fact, it's even more emphasized on Yom Kippur. I've said this idea before, but I'll just share it with you because it's so powerful. On Yom Kippur, we have also the similar idea, where the highlight of Yom Kippur in the times of the temple was the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, going into the Holy of Holies. What did he do there? He brought incense, right? He brought incense, 11 spices. He brought incense and created this cloud of smoke, which represented the presence of the Shekhinah, the divine presence, and the connection between us and God, and so on. It's a different shir to explain how, but that was a powerful moment. Today we don't have that, we talk about it. And with these 11 spices, he created this beautiful aroma, this beautiful fragrance, which the mystics tell us is a representation of the depth of the neshama, the pure smell, the pure beautiful fragrance that comes from the depth of the neshama. Similar idea. And then the Talmud tells us a fun fact, which seems random and bizarre. The Talmud says that the fragrance that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, created on Yom Kippur was so powerful that it can be felt miles away, and the goats of Jericho would sneeze. Very important information. The goats of Jericho would sneeze from the beautiful smell of the Ketoret. Nice fun fact, but the Talmud is not a book of fun facts.
They're not allergic.
I don't know if they would.
From the smell.
Yeah. So, they explain the following. They say no. The fragrance is the depth of our neshama. Yeah. Yom Kippur, we know, we start Rosh Hashanah, but Yom Kippur is the crescendo. Mm-hmm. Ne'ilah, you know, we have five levels of our soul. Ne'ilah is the fifth prayer of Yom Kippur, where we reach face to face with God. We come with our full neshama. But the Talmud says it's not good enough just for your neshama. The animals, the animalistic living that are miles away in Jericho, which wasn't a particularly holy city, the goat that's within us, that's far beyond Yom Kippur. It's not in the holiness of Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, we only focus on our soul. We don't even take care of our body. We fast. We move away from the physical. Good. You know, we do that because we want to really reveal our true soul, the true expression of the soul. But as Yom Kippur comes in, we go back to our body. And when Sukkot comes in, we go back into the real world. We go miles away in Jericho and we've got this goat within us or any other animal that's working hard. It's not interested in the fragrance of the soul, but it is. Because if we do it right and we commit and we have a plan for the year, we ensure that the faith, the emunah, the commitment that we build, the resolutions that we take on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the goats of Jericho will be affected. They'll also sneeze. And that during out the year, we'll remember that moment that we took upon ourselves just that one thing to do a little bit extra. And every time we do it, we'll remember the inspiration of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So that's the fifth lesson of the Shofar. So we're coming into a very special Rosh Hashanah, I think. There's been a lot of darkness, a lot of confusion, a lot of toughness this year, but we know that we're full of faith and we're full of strength and we're full of inspiration. We're going into a new year. Every new year, the Kabbalah tells us, is a new light, a new energy. So let's try and take Lishma, let's try and listen and absorb the lessons of the Shofar. And I just want to wish everyone, God is going to do His part for sure. And I want to wish everyone that He will definitely bless all of us and you and your families. And Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, with a Shana Tova, Mataka, and only good things. Have a wonderful Yom Tov. And don't forget Sukkot. What I tell you, it's the 9th of October.